Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Fantasy. I am your host, A.E. Lanier. Today, I will be speaking with Eliza Chan about her debut novel, Fathom Folk. Fathom Folk takes place in the semi-submerged city of Teancali, where humans and Fathom Folk, a collection of peoples, including sirens, sea witches, and kelpies, among others, navigate an increasingly tense political situation. The novel follows half-siren Mira, the recently promoted captain of the border guard, and Nami, a young exiled royal from a neighboring city, as they push for political change and grapple with the city's growing violence and social unrest. Eliza Chan is a Scottish-born speculative fiction author who writes about East Asian mythology, British folklore, and reclaiming the Dragon Lady. Her short fiction has been published in The Dark, Podcastle, Fantasy Magazine, and The Best of British Fantasy. Fathom Folk is her debut novel, and she is here with us now. Hi, Eliza. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
I was wondering if we could start by talking a little bit about the city itself. So it's this quite interesting setting. It's semi-submerged, and then the novel itself is very urban, is concerned with the politics of the city and sort of a lot of urban problems. So I was wondering if you could talk a little about the city and the role that it plays.
Yeah, I mean, I like that question, first of all, because for me, the city is almost a character in itself. So Teancali is a semi-submerged city. So in my vision when I was creating it, it was the water levels had risen, but somehow the city is surviving, mostly because it has quite a dense population, as a lot of large cities do, and there's sort of towering skyscrapers at the centre, but also in the suburbs there's a lot of buildings that are based on real buildings, actually on stilt houses, houseboats, and other sort of structures used in the real world in floodplains and sort of monsoon season sort of places. And the reason I specifically wanted it to be based in this city rather than the wider world, or rather than a rural setting, is I think a lot of the things I wanted to discuss are about multiculturalism and having lots of different cultures up against each other, and the divides between the cultures, but also the class divides and everything else that comes with being in this sort of melting pot and being sort of on top of each other. And aside from that, I think one of the other things I wanted to add, which is also why it's such a strange city that no one's ever envisaged before, is I wanted it to be East and Southeast Asian inspired, because I love cities, but I find in a lot of media, the default city that we think of when we think of something modern is we think of London, we think of New York. And they're all very Western cities, and you know, there are cities all over our world. You know, there are cities in Asia, there are cities, you know, in South America. Why aren't we touching on those? And actually, multiculturalism exists also in these other cities. It just looks different to that we're used to seeing from Hollywood. So this is very much based on more like Singapore or Ho Chi Minh or Hong Kong, where there's a lot more East and Southeast Asian sort of cultural references, but it is still multicultural. And that's why I wanted the Fathom Folk not just to be mermaids, but as you said in your brilliant introduction, there are a range of different sea folk, including Kelpies, Kappas, from the rich, diverse sort of cultures that we have in our real world. So the city in itself almost becomes this living, breathing beast for me. And that was one of my favorite parts of writing the novel.
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely going to circle back, I think, to the city, because as you said, it's so much at the center of this story. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the Fathom Folk, because we do have a whole bunch of different peoples. And so I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the choices you made there and the different things that you wanted to explore and include when doing that element of the world building?
That's a good question. So I love mythology. I'm sure having read the book, you can see that I really love the sort of Pokemon style of going, oh, there's this and there's this and there's this, and they have sort of similarities and differences. And that's very much me. I'm a bit of a magpie, and I've always loved reading about different mythologies from across the world. And I started seeing these sort of similarities when I was reading things. Firstly, nearly every culture has a water-based mythology because water's a massive part of every life as a human being. You know, there'll be rivers, lakes, bodies, you know, seas, because that is a necessity. So even if they take different forms, there is often something to do with water. And travel, obviously, is also related to water traditionally before we had flight. So you get a lot of immigration coming through water and exploration. And these things sort of mashed up in my head as to sort of looking at immigration and refugees and people just moving to different places coming across the water. And that's why I kind of thought, I'm not just going to stick to one, you know, I'm not just going to do mermaids or do kelpies. I want them to come from different cultures to show that this is like the different people that come in. The other side of it that I've not mentioned yet is on reading a lot of these, I got more and more frustrated at how many sexy seductresses there are in mythology. You know, you got those sirens that just sit there on rocks waiting for a ship full of men to come by so they can drown them. And you see that across so many mythologies: Rusalkas, mermaids, merrows, sirens. They're all either evil seductresses or damsels that are only really there to attract men. And as a woman and as a feminist, this was really frustrating me. So I decided that when we were telling this story, as well as all those other things I've mentioned, I wanted it to be about the women and centered around the women, and that I kind of saw the parallels of those sort of seductress tropes to the parallels of how often immigrant women are treated. They're kind of seen as exotic and, you know, those sort of stereotypes. And so I wanted to very much make the story about different women and what they do with this sort of burden placed on them, and center the story around them.
Yeah, absolutely. We have really, I guess, four POVs. Sort of our two central protagonists are, of course, Mira and Nami, who both have different relationships with Fathom folk generally, and also like with the city itself. And I was wondering, really, you could start with either of them, but thinking about how you wanted to bring them into the story and into this political world.
So as you mentioned, yeah, Mira and Nami are my sort of two main point of view characters. Mira is a half siren, so her father was human, her mother's siren, and she was born in the city, so she has never lived anywhere else. And I very much wanted her character to be that second generation diaspora person that is sort of feeling their way and not really figuring out where they belong and how they fit in. And I think it's the question she asks herself is similar to what I think a lot of diaspora folk have, you know, sort of come to terms with, the sort of, where do I fit in? Is this my home when I feel like I don't look like, you know, everyone else, or I don't quite feel like it's right? And the top of that, you're constantly getting parents or grandparents saying, well, there's this tradition and there's this language and you should know this because this is your roots, this is your roots. But actually, it feels a really tricky one to navigate. And that's what I wanted her questions to be. And I also wanted her to be the kind of character that's come from the bottom up. So she has come a very sort of difficult, impoverished background, and she's worked her way up through hard work. But she's also quite aware that the system is broken. And that she is kind of the poster girl for diversity, and she's very much in her position because of tokenism. And there's a sort of push-pull with her because she's trying to do the best she can by staying in the system so that she can support others later on, even though she kind of knows it's broken and, you know, it's all a bit lip servicey, like how far she can still push for that change through legal means. And then as an opposition to her, I wanted someone that was a lot angrier and fierier and, you know, wanted to tear up the rule book. So I brought in Nami. Now, Nami is a water dragon from the submerged world. So she's comes into the city near the beginning of the novel, and this is the first time she's left home. And she's young and she's impetuous, and she kind of thinks she knows everything about the world sort of character. In her heart's in completely in the right place, but she doesn't actually know all the grey areas in the city because she's never lived in it. And I wanted to show that as a difference between the sort of first and second generation, from her coming from a place of privilege, because as a water dragon she's basically the top of the hierarchy in the Havens, and she's rich, you know, and everyone looks at her in awe, and how different those sort of influences on your life can have, that even though they're both considered folk, all of those different relationships, the different background can impact on your personality, can impact on your decision making, and how this influences their characters throughout the novel, and how they see the means of change. Because the world is certainly very broken, but how they try and fix it, they both have very different ways of dealing with it.
Yeah, absolutely. That relationship that both of them have to politics, Nami being sort of this outsider, but also much younger and very radical, works really well as a foil to Mira kind of coming in and, again, working to change things, but having this longer relationship with the city and also being, in many ways, a government official. And a really central part for both of them as well is immigration, both because Mira is working as a border guard and then Nami is coming into the city. And so we're seeing sort of that process and how that works for her, both as like a privileged person and also someone that has a complicated relationship with her family as well. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about immigration and sort of like the role of refugees in this novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously we've touched on it quite a lot already. Like, yeah, immigration, refugees is very much one of my touchstones when I was thinking about the novel and thinking about what it was representing. It's all mixed up in my head, I guess. I don't think there's any very clear answer to me, because I know people make a lot of real life analogies of this, and it's not a one for one for me, but there definitely is a role of, there's legal immigration in this world, but there's quotas on it, much like our own world. And then there's illegal immigration, and there's things like refugees that exist because of strife in other parts of the world, and they're coming in. And there's a lot of discussion about, you know, who we should let in, you know, whether or not we're full, quote unquote, as we do have in real life sort of politics. And I think for me, it was examining where my parents came from, where the different, seeing also the contemporary news that was going on around the time that I was writing it, about how it's very much vilified, isn't it, the idea of immigration, but ultimately we all immigrated from somewhere if you move, you know, back enough in history. And so I wanted to show that there are different forms, you know, very much Nami or her brother who's come over as an ambassador, they're still immigrants, but they're sort of legitimate because they're, you know, higher up in the hierarchy and they've been invited over sort of things, whereas other sort of immigrants are seen as something sort of negative. But ultimately I wanted to show that they're just people, and even that they're literally look different because they're fathom folk, so they have scales and fins and stuff. Ultimately, the problems they're going through, the relationships they have, the feelings they have, they're ultimately individual people. And that's, again, circling back to the different points of view, that's very much why I wanted the different points of view, because I very much didn't want it to seem that I was using one character as a mouthpiece. I wanted to show that there's a variety, and there always has been and there always will be in different communities, and from different areas, and it's to me the book, the sort of discussion about immigration is I wanted very much to open a discussion. I don't think the book gives any easy answers because I don't think there are any easy answers. And I wanted it to be a thought piece that people would provoke people to think in and have these discussions rather than saying this is right and this is wrong. I think it's a lot more complicated and nuanced than that, which is what I've tried to show in the novel.
There's a lot of political unrest and immigration happening, but a lot of that is also happening in the context of this sort of larger climate catastrophe, which is one of the reasons why so many Fathom folk have ended up in the city and is also impacting the city itself. I feel like we see a lot of discussion of like climate catastrophe and things like that in science fiction, but less in fantasy. And so I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the role of climate and sort of natural disasters in the novel and in your work.
I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Like I see it a lot in science fiction. You know, there are a few novels that deal with it, and there's quite a lot of sort of post-apocalyptic or like disaster movies where, you know, giant waves are coming in. And I think for me, it was genuinely just, well, I like watching that stuff, but I find writing science fiction a bit tricky. So I'll write it into my fantasy and see how it goes. And it evolved actually over several short stories before it became a novel. So I'd been reading a lot about climate change. Obviously, it's quite current and we're all sort of thinking about it. And I'd been to a couple of local events at the local science museum that was talking about, well, if the water rose this much, how much of my local city would be underwater versus how much would, you know, still be out of the water. And that started my head sort of going, oh, I wonder what this would look like. And very much looking at countries in East and Southeast Asia that I know are already dealing with some extreme weather, often at times with like monsoons and typhoons and things like that, and how that they're structurally, architecturally built for this. So I just thought it was really interesting. I think where I like to sit specifically in fantasy is the more modern end of it. And for me, when you add the modernity, it often you sort of get sidelined a little bit by some people into urban fantasy. And I think for me, I was like, but having the climate thing made it such much more interesting. And just sort of thinking how it would work in terms of the functioning of the city. But also just as a reminder, you know, to myself and to the readers that this is a very real thing.
So it's sort of the macro concerns happening with climate generally, but there's also been impact in terms of pollution and the impact on daily life, which I think is particularly interesting given that in theory, Fathom folk could live quite happily in parts of the city that are inaccessible to humans. But the reality of the pollution and particularly of something called gill rot make that difficult. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about gill rot and about those impacts on the society of the novel.
I mean, if you want to lay it down fundamentally, the reason I invented gill rot was because, as you said, otherwise people would say, wait a minute, the Fathom folk can just live in the water. Why would they want to come into the city? And I was like, I need a reason. But I also invented gill rot. So gill rot is basically exactly how it sounds. It's a disease that affects gills, and it's due to the pollution caused by the city and all of the industry happening within the city. And in a way, I wanted to mirror what's happening to our seas. And I got quite into a deep dive of like coral bleaching and the coral reefs, and how there's only so much the coral can handle. So coral bleaching is happening because of the change in water temperature. And that change, because it's now happening significantly, the coral can't really deal with that level of change, and it's bleaching. And a small amount of bleaching over time, so it literally looks white if you ever looked it up, the coral can handle, but obviously if that happens longer term, it eventually dies. And this is important because coral reefs basically are incredibly important for ocean life. It's where a lot of the different plants and the animals, like the fish and everything, they all live in the coral reefs. They're like underwater forests. So if you imagine basically our forests dying above the water, which they are, this is in miniature under the water also happening. And that's why I thought of Gilroy. I thought it was a great sort of visual to show the impact that that sort of pollution would have, not just on the plants and on the sea life, but on my Fathom folk or the people that live in the sea. It also kind of gave me a good excuse to sort of heighten the conflict that, yes, they can live under the city, under the waves, but actually what they really want is to get out because they don't want their children to have gill rot, but to get out of the water. Land is so precious above ground because essentially there isn't really any ground. It's all stilt houses and man-made structures. So actually to do that, basically they're concentrated in quite like shanty towns and stuff like that, whilst the humans that are more well off, there are some poorer humans in my novel, but the well off humans are literally in the top of skyscrapers looking down, which to me, I know it might be a bit too cheesy, but there's the parallels, isn't there, like Snowpiercer style or whatever. So I just really like that. And I also really liked the idea, even above the water, there's smog surrounding a lot of the city. And to me, it was thinking of things like the smog in Victorian London. So, you know, it isn't just something that happens now, but it's, you know, it's been happening for hundreds of years, really, in our world. And there are still some occasions where smog is really bad in some of the big cities across the world. And it's, to me, it's sort of a reminder things are bad above and below the waterline. But obviously the Fathom folk are finding it a bit harder because their livelihoods are often below the waterline. And that's why they suddenly have to come up above the waves into the city.
Well, and I think that those concerns of pollution and particularly the degradation of the oceans do make this fantasy novel feel really, really contemporary in a way that is often a little bit unusual for the genre and is such a strength of the novel and I really enjoyed. I was wondering if we could switch a little bit and talk about Cordelia, who is a sea witch, and just sea witches generally when you were designing Cordelia and sort of that element. What were tropes that you wanted to examine? What were sort of spaces that you were looking to play in with that?
Thank you. Well, Cordelia, unsurprisingly, is based off Ursula, Disney's The Little Mermaid. I did want there to be hints of The Little Mermaid about this book, even though it's much wider than that. So, and for me, I guess, like, if you look at the sort of Ursula Sea Witch and The Little Mermaid, she's very vilified for basically explaining the terms and conditions of the contract, and then a foolish mermaid signs them anyway, and then she goes, well, look, this is what happens, and I told you about it. I literally talked for the small print with you, and you still signed it. And, you know, I feel that she gets a really raw deal. I think partly that aspect, but partly the aspect that she's that sort of typical 90s villain, isn't she? Where she is seen as quite grotesque and other, whereas Ariel and all of those mermaids are beautiful and skinny and pretty, and she's, you know, monstrous essentially. And I thought, actually, how much of that people viewing her as monstrous is making her more monstrous? So when I made Cordelia, partly she looks a bit like Ursula in terms of she's got the octopus lower limbs, and she is in her natural form quite sort of monstrous, grotesque looking, and she's a shapeshifter, so that she can wear lots of different faces, and she does a lot of skimming, but essentially one of the characteristics about the sea witch I made is she writes these bargains, but the bargains are ironclad. So if she breaks them, there is a sort of like lashback on her that she ends up poisoning herself if the deals are broken. And her whole life is around striking deals and making deals to better her position and her ambitions and that of her family. But also, I didn't quite want her to be sympathetic, but I did also, she's not an out and out villain to me. She's kind of like, you know what? If the world hates me and the world vilifies me, why shouldn't I just do the best for me? And in this world, she's not just vilified by the humans, it's the Fathom folk as well. Because again, when you look at minority groups, there are people within those groups that are ostracized from their own communities. That does happen. And actually, if everyone's treating you like that, why wouldn't you sort of embrace it? So that's why I was sort of playing around with her. She was really good fun to write. I did find it like difficult at first, and then I was like, oh, I get the appeal of just writing a sort of antagonist that is free to do whatever they want. And that was a really interesting one. And her role definitely grew. She was just a tiny side character in my first draft, and now she's, you know, quite a significant main character by the end.
Also, you really double down on like the octopus energy in terms of the ways that octopus like change color and stuff, which is really fun and I really enjoyed. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the role of motherhood in this novel as well, because the POV character we haven't really discussed is Serena, who is really a wife and a mother before she is anything else. She has two children, an adult son and a quite young daughter, and that really shapes her identity and the way that she moves through the world. But this novel does a great job of examining the ways in which that can be toxic as well as something that can be positive.
Oh, that's a good one. I've not actually had this question before, so nice one. Yeah, so Serena. For me, yeah, as you say, she's a character. She's in the sort of upper classes, and she's very much about looking out for her children and wanting to push them no matter what. And it comes to a point where there's certain things happen, and you know, I want very much the reader to question whether or not it was right to do these things. So I would say she's sort of like a tiger mother, where at the end of the day, she doesn't care if her children don't like her. She's not trying to be their friend. If she has got them places, if she has got them wealth or status or, you know, the position she feels they should be in, then she's done her job as a mother. And I think that does come from the sort of often from an immigrant experience of parents and grandparents saying, you know, like, I suffered for you, and I don't care that you hate me for it, but I'm sending you to uni, or you know, you're doing this, you're going to have a more stable life, stable career. And there's this tension between that sort of type of motherhood and parenting, and you know, the type that you, I guess, most of us would like, the sort of like more nurturing side, which I think I do sort of doing Trish, who's Mira's mother, is the more nurturing, listening, I'm going to be friends with you and support you whatever you do, mother. Whereas Serena is very much like, no, you might hate me, but at the end of the day, I'm going to have made you stronger. And I do think there are pros and cons to both. And I don't want to say out and out that that sort of tiger mother trope is bad, because it exists, and it, you know, it is based on a lot of real people. I just wanted to examine what that does to her relationship with her children, and what that does to her, as you say, her sense of self. Because actually, if that becomes her only reason to do things, then what happens if there is a fallout? And I better not say any more than that. But yeah, but a very good point that you raised there, actually, because the book two, which I'm editing right now, goes a lot more into examining motherhood as a concept more than book one. So I'm quite impressed you pulled that one out.
And I think that there's so much family throughout this novel as well, and the importance of these kind of intimate relationships that we have. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about Kai, who it plays different roles in different people's lives. And so both him as a character and the way that that then allows different characters to explore their relationships.
So Kai is Nami's older brother. So he's also a water dragon, but he is had been sent to the city, I think it's 2 years previous, as the ambassador, because he's also from the Underwater Haven. And he, slight spoiler, but you know, you find out he's No, it's not a spoiler, is it? You find out he's dating Mira. So, as you say, he's different things. He's Mira's partner, but he's also Nami's older brother. And what I was doing with him, first and foremost, is I wanted a male character that who was like positive and sympathetic, but I also wanted a male character that was very much a supporter. I think we often see women in support roles in a lot of media, you know, sort of like, here's the wife at home, that's so supportive. And he kind of, for me, I was turning that on its head. So he's the supportive wife at home. You know, he very much supports people by, you know, bringing them cups of tea and listening to their problems and being like, you can do it. And he supports Mira in her sort of campaigning for improving the lot of Fathom folk. And he also tries to be a good brother for Nami, but that's a bit trickier because there's been years of between when they last saw each other because he's been in Teancowie for so long. But that's ultimately wanted. I wanted a character that was a bit softer and supportive, but a male character, which is like shocking. He's nurturing. But as you say, like for me, having the different relationship, he's sort of like the bridge between the two, because obviously their points of view differ, and he's the bridge between them that sort of brings them together in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to talk just briefly as well about the role of different languages in the novel, and in particular, there's also sign in the novel. So I was wondering if you could think of discuss sort of the role that language played in world building in this book.
So in the book, they all speak mostly Teancowian, which is the main language of the city. But obviously, I have characters coming from different havens, which are the underwater sort of lands. So there are hints of other languages, and Nami speaks another language, but you know she can do fine in Teancowie because she's been raised multilingual because she's an upper class child, so she went to the good schools. But I very much wanted Mira to feel out of place. So Mira only knows Teancowien because she's never lived anywhere else. And, you know, there's a couple of times where characters are like, oh, shouldn't you know this? Or they try to talk to her in another language and she actually doesn't understand them. And I wanted to show the stark difference that because of her upbringing, because of her being born in the city, there's this degree of separation from that culture and that sort of isolation that she feels. On top of that, I really loved adding little bits about code switching and bits about characters noticing that accents would change depending on who they're with, because that's something that I really enjoy. So, you know, I've lived overseas. I trained as a speech and language therapist, and I really love certain things you do. Like, if I was speaking to a Scottish person right now, I would be a lot more Scottish than I am speaking to you. When I'm with other people that speak Chinese, I'll switch in and out depending on what words I know better and what language, and that's very comfortable for me. So I wanted to hint at these sorts of things without fully going Tolkien and making up a new language, because my brain doesn't work that way. The signing as well that you mentioned is because I wanted to make the Fathom folk be able to speak underwater, because obviously that makes sense. They're from areas that are underwater, but humans can't speak underwater. We all know they can't speak underwater. So what will we do? So in reality, scuba divers use very simple signs to talk to each other underwater for safety and things like that. And I thought, great, that's what I'll adopt. So there is some signing that's used, and that's more sort of understood by a lot more people, because obviously some of the humans do go underwater for certain periods of time. And yeah, I'm obviously, you can tell I'm into my languages a bit. So that's sort of what I was doing with all of that.
Yeah, it's such a really lovely, fun piece of the novel as well. And overall, this is just such a interesting and fun world, and we've got a lot of different perspectives and the ways that they're interacting with it. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today, or to speak with me today. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you. I really enjoyed those questions. They were incredibly insightful, and it's been lovely.
All right, thank you so much. I have been speaking with Eliza Chan about her novel Fathom Folk, out now from Orbit. Thank you so much for listening, and please consider feeding the algorithms that run our lives by subscribing, following, leaving a review, all that good stuff. I will speak to you soon, and for now, happy reading.